Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is New Books in Law. Thank you for joining us on the New Books Network. Today we are discussing a new book in constitutional law and theory regarding Donald Trump and how he has conducted his presidency. It's called Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, and we're joined today by the author John Yu. Professor Yu is a professor at University of California, Berkeley, the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law. He's also a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Previously, he served as an official in the U.S. Justice Department during the George W. Bush administration, as general counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a law clerk to United States Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. John Yu, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Oh, Ian, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So this is a book that you sounded like you were reluctant to write, or at least surprised you were writing based on the introduction, because you did not start out as a Donald Trump fan. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. 4 years ago, I was not a supporter of Donald Trump. I was quite skeptical, wary of him. I think as many people, I think, back then who are, I guess you could say, or originalists on the Constitution or involved in Republican politics were. And particularly what worried me is that he was campaigning as a populist, and populists always sort of run into the Constitution. I think of populists as people who go out to the country, claim a mandate to overthrow the existing order or the status quo or the way of doing things. And usually it's a constitution that establishes the old way of doing things, that slow things down, and I think are very frustrating to populists.
And you consider yourself an originalist who is much interested in whether or not power today is exercised in accord with the way the Constitution was originally intended to operate, right?
Yeah, I think it's fair to call me an originalist. I've been doing that kind of research in my scholarly work back since the early 90s, I guess. And I'm also interested in other things, but in terms of interpreting the Constitution, that's been my primary methodology, yes.
So, of course, Donald Trump is one of the things for which he is famous, and the way he campaigned in 2016 was by releasing his intended nominees or prospective nominees for the federal judiciary, especially the Supreme Court. And many of them are considered to be originalists. And that it has certainly endeared many people that I know who are originalists to support him, although they might not support him for other reasons. So beyond his judicial selections, however, what other reasons might originalists be enthusiastic about Trump in 2020?
That's interesting. I think there's a lot of the same reasons in 2016. And I have to say, I thought that a lot of Trump's policy proposals back 4 years ago and again today are ones I generally favor and Republicans generally favor. I mean, it's almost very Reagan-esque, cutting taxes, reducing the size of the federal government, limiting federal power, deregulation, relying more on the states. If you look at the platform from 4 years ago, I don't think there's a platform now, but the platform, I think they just cut and pasted the platform from 4 years ago. It wasn't that different than a lot of the traditional Republican Party. The people say the Republican Party's built on three stools often, anti-communism or vigorous foreign defense, which I happen to agree with, and then free market economics, which I also happen to agree with, and then this more limited role for the federal government and reliance more on the states, and which I also happen to agree with. So that wasn't his domestic policies that really worried me back then. And in fact, I would say, despite all of the political controversy and sometimes chaotic politics, Trump has certainly been divisive politically, and he certainly, I think, has disrupted the normal way of running politics. I think in terms of limits on the federal government and deregulation, cutting taxes, I mean, he seems to have kept his promises, and particularly, as you said, he really did on appointing originalist judges and justices to the court.
So in terms, though, of proposing a renewal of his contract on the White House for another 4 years, does his performance in office over the last 3.5 years, based on the book, of course, this is a loaded question, it makes you feel better about him being reelected?
Oh, yes. I mean, compared to 4 years ago. And it's about who he isn't, because one of the reasons I explain in the book why over the last 4 years I came to a more favorable view of Trump is how far his opponents are willing to go in overturning constitutional traditions and systems and norms in order to bring him down. And so that's one of these really worries me. Even though Trump is the one who's accused often of wanting to break constitutional principles, it's actually, you go through the platforms or what people say these days, it's Trump's opponents who are the ones who are in favor of getting rid of the Electoral College. I think you've written about this too. They want to use this National Popular Vote Initiative to try to evade the founders, I think, pretty elaborate and carefully balanced idea about how to pick the president. The Amy Coney Barrett nomination that we're in the midst of right now is another good example. Trump's opponents are threatening to pack the court to add 6 new justices, which expand the court by 2/3 of its membership, because they are upset that President Trump is nominating and the Senate might confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the vacancy created by the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which is, certainly within their constitutional powers. We can argue about whether politically it's a great idea or not, but presidents have certainly done this in the past. People say that the Republicans in the Senate are being hypocrites, but they haven't broken any serious constitutional norms that's even close to, I think, undermining the political the independence of the court system. It's not Trump as his opponents who say things like sending federal law enforcement to quell disorder in some of our cities, as we're seeing in Portland or Chicago, is tantamount to fascism and sending occupying Trump armies into our cities. I wish those were the fevered bloggings of left-wing activists, but those are words that have appeared on the New York Times editorial page. And, I think Trump's opponents also would work a serious harm to the separation of powers, because they want to create more independent, permanent special counsels to investigate the government. And they want to, I think, override the limits on the federal government by nationalizing energy, transportation, housing through this Green New Deal. So I kind of think in the book, I argue that this has turned Trump into this unintentional, maybe most surprising defender of the Constitution, just by defending the existing order against, a sort of radical wing of the Democratic Party that really wants to undo the way we have run ourselves for a long time.
That's right. I think there's my interpretation as I read the book was that there's this implicit irony in the fact that Trump has and relishes himself this reputation of being a bull in a china shop and overturning norms. But ironically, your argument is that he, in fact, upholds a tradition of an independent and strong executive, whereas some of his predecessors who give the appearance of being much more adherent to norms, in fact, willingly violate these norms.
Yeah, I think it's been remarkable. You wouldn't have, I would not have predicted that 4 years ago. I bet a lot of people would not have predicted that 4 years ago. But I think Trump, and I think it's because Trump has been so disruptive to the political system that his opponents are willing to entertain, I think, truly radical. For example, take court packing. And this is something that first, constitutionally, Congress does have the power to set the number of justices on the Supreme Court and the size and shape of the lower courts as well. But this is an idea, packing the courts to achieve a political outcome. Sounds like you've got some angry Democrats there in the House. But they don't like my book.
No.
I don't blame them.
Well, the hazards of doing things from your home office.
But just on this corporate, no, that's no problem. I love dogs. You know, like as Harry Truman once said, right? If you want to have a friend in Washington, get yourself a dog. But the point of court backing is, even though constitutionally it's possible for Congress to do this, we have long had this norm, I think, since the first Jefferson administration, basically, to not use that power to try to manipulate the courts and the justices to get the results we want. And we've had 9 justices now. I mean, the numbers fluctuated, not a lot. We've never had serious court packing, but, you know, fluctuated. And we've had 9 since around, during Reconstruction, I think since 1869. So for about 100 and almost 150 years. And even FDR, who might have, you know, in 1937, who might have won one of the great re-elections of all time, where he won an enormous electoral college victory. His party controlled 2/3 of the House and the Senate. I mean, they could have passed constitutional amendments if they felt like it. Even FDR tried this. In fact, he had the same proposal. He didn't like the way the Supreme Court was voting on the New Deal. And he proposed adding 6 new justices to the Supreme Court. And even his own party turned against him. And many historians say FDR had gone too far and effectively received such a political blow that kind of ended the New Deal right there.
Well, this is an aspect of your book. You don't really address at length the court packing plan. Of course, this is something that's come to the fore since the book's been published. But I am interested in your thoughts on the political culture now. In 1937, after FDR is reelected in 36, he introduces this court packing plan, and really he could have probably achieved it in terms of raw numbers in the Congress, but the people who are among the resistors are fellow Democrats who are New Dealers. It seems to me that the political culture and the, if you will, and I know this is an overused metaphor, but the tribalism, tribal-like divide between left and right today, I'm not so sure there would be too many, no matter which party it was, who would necessarily resist the executive in their own party who wanted to perhaps change the court. Do you think the culture's changed in that sense?
I mean, you're the political scientist, not me, so I don't really, you know, have a great sense of how the parties work, but I could say back in the, you're right, in the 1930s, there was a different political culture, and the parties were more ideologically diverse, I guess. So the Democratic Party back then was made up of Western and Northeastern liberals, but Southern Democrats were more conservative. And the Republican Party had conservatives and liberals too. And so I actually blame you political scientists for the shape we're in, because political scientists, I don't know if you're so when I went to school and was doing this kind of reading, and I tried to keep a little bit, but remember the politics of the 50s and 60s was seen as too moderate. You know, they didn't like these ideals. The political scientists hated these moderate parties, which sucked in all the new movements and prevented, and were ideologically diverse internally. So people didn't like that in political science because the parties didn't present clear ideological choices like the parties do in Europe, for example. You know, well, now we got their wish. Right now we have two right. political parties, and one's definitely conservative, one's definitely liberal, and we have clear choices now in our elections about Republican versus Democrat. And so one result of that, I think, Ian, is I agree with you at the bottom line, is now if a party takes power like the Democratic Party and they want to pack the court, there's going to be less of an internal fight as there was in 1937 in the Democratic Party, where the, you know, different parts of the party will restrain the leadership. Let me add, this is also, you know, this is not going to end in 2021 if the Democrats do this. Republicans will almost certainly counter and do the same thing. In fact, I think court packing, if I was to look at the last 30, 40 years, court packing has probably been more popular amongst conservatives who've wanted to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I always thought, and one reason, and you're right, it's not that extensively discussed in the book, because when I wrote this book, I thought it was a fringe idea. I mean, it always has been a fringe idea, but it's not a fringe idea anymore. And so ironically, I think one reason I have had a more favorable view of Trump is that, again, unintentionally and surprisingly, he's defending the idea of an independent judiciary with nine justices and not meddling with the size of the courts against people who, I think, if we start down this path, courts might just become like agencies where you just add more people during your term in office and they just follow the policies you want while you happen to have power, which I think would be terrible for our country.
So let's turn to more of the substance of the arguments that you make in the book. By the title, it would seem like this is going to be a book primarily about Trump, but really it's equal parts constitutional history, especially the history of the original understanding and intentions, or the debates about what the executive was going to be like ever since the Philadelphia Convention of 1787. And so you categorize the different areas of executive power, and we can talk about any of these that you think are most germane. I was especially interested in the war making, war initiating, war declaration powers, and the division between the executive and Congress, and the notions of what does it mean to be able to declare war and so forth. So I'm particularly interested in that, we can talk about any aspect of this.
No, that's my favorite subject.
Okay. All right. That's right. You have written a history of presidential power from Washington to the current day.
First you have found me out, because yes, the book appears to be about Trump, but really it was a trick. It was a trick to try to get people who would just buy a book about Trump to learn something about the presidency too. And so you're right, it's probably more a book about presidential history and the original understanding of executive power than it is about Trump. I mean, it's not heavily into, although there is, I think, quite a bit about the scandals and the investigations and impeachment, because they all involve the Constitution too. But let me talk about the war power briefly, because this is probably the thing I've worked on longest. I mean, it's the first major scholarly article I wrote was about the war power back in the 90s. And the reason it attracted me, and I think it's still interesting, is, as a scholar, it's always, maybe if you're a contrarian scholar, you're always drawn to issues where scholars say one thing almost unanimously, and then the world does something different. usually the world, I think, turns out to be right. So then you want to figure out, why are we, the scholars, so wrong? And I got to think, there's one issue where that was true for a long time. It was the war power. So you have presidents who have for a long time used force abroad without any congressional authorization, certainly no declaration of war. We've only had five declarations of war. The last one was World War II. We have had many, many wars during those years and since, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. Now, some of those have had what we call an authorization to use force from Congress, like Afghanistan and Iraq, which I also happened to have worked on when I was at the Justice Department. But many important wars haven't, like Korea, for example, had no declaration of war or, any explicit statutory authorization. On the other hand, scholars almost unanimously said that's all unconstitutional. because the Constitution in Article 1 gives Congress the power to declare war. So to me, this extreme conflict between practice and scholarly opinion, it just seems something was wrong there. So I started to work on, back then, I still work on now, this question of, well, what's the proper allocation of the war power under the Constitution, given that presidents have seemed to have violated the Constitution dozens and dozens, if not 100 times in our history then, according to these scholars, some of these scholars. So one thing I thought, I think there's always a value. I was just 26 years old when I did this. You know, I'm not that long out of college or law school. And I said, oh, maybe I'll just read the Constitution straight through and look at every place it talks about war. And I just came across this provision, which I thought almost settled the question to me. So in Article 1, Section 8, of course, it says Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. And so people say, oh, that phrase to declare war, that means start war. Notice it doesn't have an exception for self-defense or anticipatory self-defense, you know, cases where a country attacks us first or seems to attack us first. So scholars also say, and there's an explicit, there's a hidden exception in there for when someone attacks us. But if you just turn the page of your trusty Constitution to two sections later, there's something, Article 1, Section 10, and it says, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. So the thing when I was just like, I'm a young guy, and I say, that provision is exactly what people think the Declare War Clause does. You could have just said, no president shall without the consent of Congress. And it even has the exceptions everyone concedes have to be in the Declare War Clause. So I'm like, the thing that occurs to me is, why would the framers have written out such a careful provision with all the things we want in it and then not use it for the president and we use it, but we use it for the states? That doesn't make any sense at all. And so that led me to this view that actually the way Congress checks presidents is not through declarations of war or authorizations. The way it does it is the way it worked under the parliament and the king, which is Congress controls the funding. Congress controls the size and shape of the military. That was a perfect check through till World War II because we didn't have a large military. So presidents would say, okay, I'm going to have a war in Mexico, right, in 1846. And they have to go to Congress and say, please build me the army to go to war with Mexico. Congress has to give its approval or not. They have to vote. And so I think reading the constitutional text and the structure this way made better sense of practice, that we just had not silently amended the Constitution in this huge area, maybe the most important thing the government does is a wage war, as many scholars thought. Sorry for going on so long, but I think I just find that so interesting, those textual provisions in the Constitution available to anybody sitting there for 230 years to see.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so essentially you are arguing that our conception of the executive should be better informed by the subjective, sometimes made formally these statements that, but these subjective perspectives that the framers had, which was the experience that Europe had had under, and England in particular, under the way the crown had operated as an institution vis-a-vis Parliament.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Ian, because there's some divide amongst originalists about this, about how to, what history you should properly use. So my view is, right, all these people who wrote and ratified the Constitution until just a few years earlier, they had all been British. They had all been educated as British lawyers. Their background principles were all the British Constitution. In fact, if you look at the phrases of our Constitution, they're all, you find them all in Blackstone, right, which was the great statement of British law hanging around at that time. And so these phrases, commander-in-chief, declare war, commerce, they're all discussed in these British sources. And are, what I think of is the founders, they got to the Constitution, right? This is, by the way, Constitution version 2.0. Version 1.0, the Articles of Confederation do the same thing, but in a failed way. And they just sort of, the founders just sort of remove, change, you know, they might change, rearrange those provisions in certain ways. But to understand what the phrases mean, I think we have to go back to that British understanding, because that was the background against which they were acting.
So one way, I suppose, that you, that one, if I'm doing my duty as a host, I push back on this notion of maybe this isn't, you don't restrict this to a linguistic argument of choice of terms, but perhaps the you say we're getting hung up on this word of declaration as assuming that it's essentially equivalent to initiate. Mm-hmm. And the way of perhaps pushing back on this notion would be that one of the fears, of course, of people from the founding generation, especially that group in society that was educated in terms of classical education, the fears that everyone had regarding things like, and this would be from the English Civil War, but also Roman history, which many of them were knowledgeable about based on their educations of the time, which is the fear of the standing army and the tyrant and what the independent power and ambitions that they assumed everyone held in power, wouldn't we have expected that perhaps they would have been a little more express on trying to restrict the power of the executive in the new nation that they were, because that they were founding? In other words, they are starting anew in one sense, but at the same time, they see themselves as being informed by the wisdom of the ages, and that declaring war sounds like, in common parlance, perhaps a ability to initiate. But what you're arguing is that they really anticipated a much freer hand for the executive. And how do we reconcile that with the assumptions that I think many of them had about power being concentrated in one person and being abused?
And that's a great question. And I think that actually is it's sort of how we put it. It's a, your question, I think, illustrates, again, this sort of divide amongst originalists about the use of sources and how to understand the founding. So there are a group of scholars who make that same argument, rely on that same train of thought, which is why should we treat the Constitution as a moment that would bolster executive power, given that we're talking about a founding generation that had rebelled against King George III and had been concerned about the growth of the crown and executive power in Britain, and, you know, goes back, right? As you say, there are classical sources that they are very familiar with, that they praise. There's this has just sort of anti-crown. It's hard to say it's a political theory, but it's sort of very popular works at the time of the 18th century. It's called sort of the country ideology. I think this is what Bernard Bailyn discovered, you know, this famous historian at Harvard, and it was sort of transmitted pamphlets and so on. And it, you know, one of the questions he asked, which I had quite taken with, is why would these people have rebelled at all? They had it so good materially. They had been so, they had lived under a period of benign neglect. You know, people in America and the colonies were freer and probably wealthier on average than anybody ever before. And had so much freedom, and yet they still saw what was happening in this very conspiratorial way. And so they rebelled, they overthrow the British here in America, and it's very anti-executive. I completely agree with that. But I also think then if you take the story to the next chapter, which is what happens between the revolution and the Constitution. And here I'm very much influenced by the work of Gordon Wood, who sort of picks up the story after Balin. And Wood says that, yes, all of that is true. But what happened during this period between 1776 and 1787 is extreme disorder and chaos in the states. That states did, when they became independent from the crown, they did put into place these kinds of constitutions that expressed a fear of the executive. So my original home state, Pennsylvania, had in its 1776 constitution, they got rid of a single governor. They had a council of 12 rotating people who were chosen by the legislature, and they served for a year, and then they were out. That's how afraid they were of an executive. And what Wood says is, those systems were so disordered, they proved so oppressive to minority rights, that they were so inconstant. They were just given to whim and unfairness, that the people who gathered together in Philadelphia, the people who then fought for the ratification of the Constitution, like George Washington or Alexander Hamilton or James Madison, they changed their minds about executive power, and they thought one of the defects of the systems in the states was their lack of strong executives. And so you see in the Constitution this very unlikely but restoration of executive power to a single executive, the thing you thought they would have feared back in 1776, they come back to, because they now see the defects of having a legislature that's all powerful. And so I think the question then that you're raising, and that I try to respond to in the book and in other books, is how far do we read that restoration of the executive? I mean, they don't give the president the same powers of the crown, but they do restore some of the powers. And so I argue one of the powers they do restore is the power to make war.
And so the real restriction then on executive power in war making is really the power of the purse. And this is where the vesting clause in Article 2, which vests the presidency or the executive with the executive power, your argument is essentially that that executive power really is a war-making and initiating power, and that the check, if you will, on it, the check and balance from the Congress, is essentially the idea of defunding the war.
Yes, or never building the military in the first place. And so to me, at the time of the writing of the Constitution and through till 1945, I'd say, that was a perfect check. Because the Congress deliberately kept our military small, because as you said, there was throughout this fear of standing armies in our political culture and in the Constitution, that there was no army for a president to really wage war with. Every conflict of any significance, the president would have to go to Congress after he wants to start war, and say, please, build me the military. The thing that changes is World War II and then the Cold War, and the idea that the lesson to learn from World War II is that we should not have, after World War I, withdrawn back to the United States, that we should have demobilized, but instead we're going to have a permanent military. And so I argue, and this is more the political end of it, I argue that the way things are now are the way Congress likes it. They don't want to vote on wars. They don't like taking responsibility. So, but they also understand that over the long term, there are these threats from abroad that we don't want to reach our shores. So we want to give the president the ability to act quickly and decisively and swiftly. The phrases that Hamilton uses to describe the executive in the Federalist Papers. And so what Congress has done, Congress, I think, is just fully responsible, but they don't want to be responsible. So Congress is the one that created a military that is really designed solely for offensive operations in other people's countries. As we saw, unfortunately, on 9/11, there are very few military forces in the United States at any one time defending the territory of the country. There, we have what's called an expeditionary military. It's designed to fight overseas so that the wars never get here onto our territory. Congress doesn't have to do that. You know, if Congress really is worried about the president being a military adventurer, they could design and build a different kind of military. So in this respect, it's kind of like the administrative state to me. Congress builds this huge thing, understands or even delegates to the president this power to use it. And then Congress doesn't have to take responsibility. And if it doesn't turn out well, they can blame the president for it. And if it turns out well, they could say they were supporting him the whole time.
Well, you bring up Congress, and this book really is more about the executive and how it's functioned both historically and today. And Congress in some ways is on the periphery by virtue of the subject matter of your book. But I do want to ask you about how Congress itself has changed in some ways in tandem or in response to the executive over time. And what you think about that in terms of what it lays at the foot of the executive, because obviously what you're arguing for here and in other works you've written is in some ways a strong executive, the so-called unitary executive theory that embraces partly a historical but also a theoretical understanding of an independent executive that wields power as only one person can. With the efficacy and the energy and dispatch that the framers thought that that one person could exercise power. But at the same time, of course, this is a republic and we have representatives that theoretically, as intended by the founders, were supposed to deliberate. But as you note, we don't have as much of a deliberative body anymore. When that happened historically is an interesting discussion point. But what I want to ask you about is, we've got this legislature that wants to abjure any real responsibility for governing and decision making. And so how does that affect the constitutional role of the executive? Because obviously the executive has become over the last century far more powerful than probably in some ways the framers ever could have imagined it would be, because of the choices made by the legislature. But what do you think of as some of the problems, as you understand the situation today in terms of governance vis-a-vis constitutional intentions for the legislature?
Yeah, to me, I'm not sure if the founders came, forward to today and they saw our system, and they would say, God, the thing that's really outside our realm of imagination was the presidency, because I still think they thought the presidency would be very important for national security, defense and war and emergencies, which is a lot of what we've just discussed. The thing what they would find surprising, I believe, would be the administrative state, which I think really is the example of what you're talking about, what you're asking about, which is this huge change in our constitutional system. Mostly the result of Congress, not the president, which has unbalanced our constitutional system and our separation of powers. How did that happen? All these powers to legislate, to set the rules that govern our society, at the federal level and the areas of federal competence are in Congress. They're in Article 1, Section 8. The separation of powers that I write about, and the reason this is interesting, I argue in the book that it doesn't even – the system doesn't even require Trump to, show up to work and look at his to-do list and have defend the Constitution as number one. Right? Our separation powers of system actually functions when, or at least the founders thought it would, when each branch just pursues its rational self-interest. And so it expected the president and the Congress to continuously fight with each other using all their constitutional powers, and that conflict would keep the government limited, and that it would still preserve an area of, private, what we call civil society now, for all of us, and preserve our freedoms. And what happened, though, and this is you describe when it happened is an interesting question. What happened was Congress at some point said, we don't want to make those decisions anymore. We're not going to get reelected if we keep deciding, how clean the air should be, or how much fuel consumption our cars should have, or what should govern in the workplace or not. So Congress, I think this is Woodrow Wilson's idea, one of the maybe the greatest political scientists in American history. He went to Europe. He saw how the German bureaucracy worked. He came back entranced. And his view was we shouldn't have politicians make any of these decisions because they're all scientific decisions, or they deserve, they require technical expertise or professional judgment. So let's create these huge agencies, give them, Congress should transfer to them all the power. And then they, rather than the 18th century idea of the Constitution, which I think Trump is, again, unintentionally promoting, which is politicians, we elect them and they are in charge of the government and they make these decisions. Wilson's idea was, right, we should isolate and insulate these decision makers as much as possible from politics. And then I think this idea becomes just firmly rooted and established. And I think we still live in Wilson's Republic now, because this idea becomes firmly established then during the New Deal in response to the Great Depression, and then, you know, goes on steroids in the Great Society with the vast expansion of the welfare state. And that, I think, is really the constitutional anomaly in our system. Congress's fault entirely. But, you know, at the same time, it's so big, it's so vast, I'm not really sure whether it enhances the president's powers. Of course, Congress doesn't want the president to exercise full control over all those agencies, so it tries to make some of them independent. On the other hand, also, but everything the agencies are doing all the time, it really seems to be outside the control of one person and the White House, his small group of aides, to control. And so I'm not sure either the president or the Congress really won in this great, this vast transfer of power to these agencies. But that is, I think that's really the thing that Congress did, led to the end of deliberation in Congress, is it constitutionally unbalances our system. No one has figured out really yet a way to contain it or reverse it.
So it seems to me that there's a conundrum for somebody like you, where you argue that on the one hand, Trump has preserved a kind of executive or the version of executive governance that the framers had in mind, and that you enjoy that as a performance of governance. But at the same time, you've always got this qualifier, which is that it's unintentional, it's unlikely, unexpected. And that's because of the particular individual, Trump himself. And it seems to me that one of the other things that the framers or that generation assumed was a necessity for good governance was also good character and wisdom. Now, Trump, in many people's minds, is the antithesis of wisdom. And so if...
Yeah, what they've called virtue. They refer to virtue all the time. Yes.
Sure. Virtue. And so in that sense, do you think it's important that even though he is unlikely or unexpectedly preserving certain traditions, or at least the expectations that the framers wanted the executive and assumed it would uphold, since his character is questioned, does that make you fearful about the wielding of such power by somebody like Trump individually?
It's a great question. This is obviously something that really troubled the founders. In some ways, they didn't face it because they all knew George Washington was going to be the first president. But you can certainly see it in other parts of the Constitution, like the Electoral College. You know, the Electoral College was an explicit rejection of the idea we should have one single national vote by simple majority for a president, right? That we would, the democracy would be filtered through the state legislatures and then through the choice of electors. And the founders actually didn't really expect, as far as I can tell, that the Electoral College would yield a winner all the time or most of the time, that they would have multiple candidates and it would often go to the House. On the other hand, I don't think the founders were naive. James Madison says in the Federalist Papers, in fact, you know, if men were angels, then you wouldn't need any government. And so he says, basically, we have to design a constitution for the men we have before us who are not angels. And so that's the idea, I think, behind the way they thought the separation of powers would work, is that it didn't require people like a Washington, you know, people of the highest virtue or the greatest learning. It was built for regular people to become politicians. And what they thought then, and this is, so I think, I think some people have written about this, not really in law, but more in history and political sciences, right? This is done and written around the same time as Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, and it has the same flavor to it. You know, Wealth of Nations, this idea, you, me, we just pursue our self-interest when we buy things in the market or we sell our goods and services. We're just trying to get the biggest profit for ourselves or reduce, have the lowest, short, the smallest losses. And then Smith says, but by pursuing our self-interest, the market as a whole creates greater social welfare, you know, with the invisible hand. We don't even know we're doing it. And I read the Federalist Papers and the founders' comments about the separation of powers is very much the same, that presidents are going to just pursue their self-interest. They may not even have these higher constitutional values in mind. And Congress and the courts are going to do the same thing. And then Madison says, right, he says, ambition will counteract ambition. You know, that, yes, this pursuit of self-interest will actually lead to conflict, which was good in their minds, that it would make sure the federal government stays within its limits, and that it will only act when there's a lot of agreement. And that agreement must mean that the public really wants something or it's in the public interest. So to me, when I read that from the founding, it seems to me Trump doesn't have to be a saint for the system to work. We've had a lot of presidents who have had difficult characters and not the best of backgrounds. And yet, nonetheless, the system continues to work. You know, I would point, you know, as an example, you know, Trump often likes to, I mean, I don't think Trump himself, but people watch Trump often compare him to Andrew Jackson, who was a general, but also, you know, a very wild guy, you know, and the criticism of him was very similar to the criticism of Trump. People were like, who is this uncouth, you know, uneducated frontiersman who's, you know, come and taken over Washington? But, you know, in turn, it becomes, I think, one of our great consequential presidents, too.
Well, one of the descriptions that you give when you're summing up Trump's impact as an executive is that Trump, as you say, may have caused what you call a seismic shift in the nature of government. And that, I assume, is you have in mind partly his populist approach and appeal and the unlikely or perhaps unexpected combination of a kind of originalist approach to the executive branch. Do you think that one of the impacts of the Trump presidency, whether it's a single term or two terms, is going to be a greater respect for the office of the executive and its traditional functioning? Will that be a renewal of executive governance in a way that we find palatable rather than tyrannical?
It's a great question. One thing I say in the book, which I think is what I thought was an interesting lesson. It's not clear to me, and we tend to look at it as past presidents like this. Oh, they did these things, set these precedents, expanded presidential power in these ways, and then presidents in the future benefited when they were faced with, you know, the emergencies and problems. And I say, you know, the interesting thing about Trump and executive power, for the most part, not in foreign affairs, but in domestic affairs, he hasn't done that. He's really used the Constitution and the president's and presidential power as a shield. You know, he's been under constant attack for 4 years, questioning his legitimacy, first with the Russia collusion investigation and then impeachment. And so I argue, actually, his use of the presidency isn't setting new precedents. New examples of expanded presidential power for the future. He's really used the Constitution to defend himself from people who would like to eject him from office before the election in November. And so it doesn't have that kind of precedent-setting expansion of power effect, I think. Now, foreign affairs, that's been different. But again, interestingly, as a policy matter, what he's been doing with claims that, you know, he can, and, you know, start hostilities or claims that he can set the foreign policy of the United States in conflict with Congress, has it been, again, interestingly, a withdrawal rather than an expansion of what presidents have done in the past. So, you know, when you and I start out talking about the war power, we traditionally have this idea, oh, the presidents are the ones who have this instinct and desire to start wars. It glorifies them. And Congress is the more peaceful branch. Presidents want to go around and make lots of agreements with other countries, and Congress is more modest about what the United States should commit to abroad. That's the opposite under Trump. You know, now Trump is using executive power in war to pull troops out of places like Syria, reduce troops in Iraq, maybe pull us out of Afghanistan, threatening to pull us out of Germany, Japan, and South Korea, where troops have been, you know, since the end of World War II. And he's also gone around the world. You know, so the president's the more peaceful branch right now, and the Congress is the more warlike branch. Trump's also gone around and claiming this power of foreign policy. He's not engaging us in more commitments. He's been breaking treaties left and right, right? He's pulled us out of the Paris Global Warming Accords, and he's pulled us out of the Iran nuclear deal, and he's terminated two arms control agreements with the Russians. He's terminated the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. So it's interesting. He's actually the branch that wants to reduce engagement with the world, and it's the Congress that wants to have more engagement. So both, I see this parallel in both domestic and foreign affairs. It was hard to figure out what the organizing theme there was, but I think in both cases, he's actually using executive power in a weird way to actually reduce the reach of the federal government and reduce the reach of the executive as a policy matter. So it's not clear to me that sets any future presidents for, say, a President Biden or maybe 4 years from now, President Pence, to say, oh, I have this new power to handle something that hasn't happened before, because Trump hasn't really done that.
So in terms of executive power, it seems to me that one lesson some conservatives have drawn this from the Obama presidency is that one thing that in achieving certain policy goals, the Obama presidency may have learned from its experience with DACA and DAPA is that there are things that the executive can simply attempt to do. They will be challenged in courts, but in the meantime, that executive policy will be realized in some fashion. But, and that was certainly the case with DACA, and your book has been, was in press, I assume, before the ruling on the Supreme Court ruling on the drawdown or the dismantling of the DACA program. And the argument that executive governance goes beyond constitutional power is certainly one that is tested by this notion of what is the branch that's going to check it, because Congress in some ways leaves the field, and that leaves the judiciary. And certainly we've seen during the presidency of Trump, you have these so-called nationwide injunctions that federal district courts are issuing. And that seems to be the site of resistance in some ways to the exercise of Trump's constitutional powers. So how do you see, in other words, recent presidential history as effectuating limits on executive power vis-a-vis the courts?
It's a really interesting question you're asking. You're right. I wrote the book before the Supreme Court decided the DACA-DAPA case over the summer, and I was very critical of those programs. I thought they violated the president's obligation to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, as Article 2 says, and that President Obama didn't have the right to say, I disagree with the policy Congress set in the immigration law, so I'm just not going to enforce them, as to, you know, estimates range from 6 to 8 million cases of aliens who are not legally in the country. So it's interesting. This actually shows an example of what I was talking about. So President Trump, you know, comes into office, he declares, you know, I think he uses executive power in this way I've been talking about before. So he claims the right of prosecutorial discretion, which is the same right that Obama claimed he had to institute the DACA-DAPA programs, which is, I can't prosecute every violation of federal law in the country every time with every person. So I'm going to manage limited resources and, you know, allocate prosecution resources to where the cases are most important. So Trump comes in the office and says, I disagree with Obama. I'm restoring the way we enforce the immigration laws to the way they were before. It seems to me one of the actual checks on executive power is executive power itself, the right to undo what the last president did, you know, issue an executive order to undo the last executive order, terminate a treaty that the last president made. The thing that surprises me is that the courts, gets to your second half of your question, the courts have stepped in and have tried to limit Trump's use of executive power, I think in very traditional ways. So here they said President Trump couldn't end DACA and DAPA using the same method that President Obama had used to create them. Instead, he has to go through this process called the Administrative Procedure Act, which is a quite detailed and lengthy process, usually just used for regulations. It's never been applied to the decision what cases to prosecute or not. I thought that was remarkable. In fact, I can't think of another example where presidents are not allowed to undo what their predecessors had done. And then second, actually the weird thing is that it might give President Trump a lot more unintended power than the courts might have thought when they were trying to restrict him, which is, well, what if President Trump now says, as he has, well, I'm not going to collect Social Security taxes anymore? Because I think in a pandemic with the economy suffering Great Depression-like losses, the IRS should spend its time doing something else other than making people pay 6% of their income. They should have that money and spend it in the economy. I think this is a good example. The courts have been more and more hostile to President Trump, but some of the unintended consequences of what they're I think of their misreading of the law has been, ironically, to give the president, I think, even more power.
So you began this book describing your personal dislike for some of the style and the policy proposals of Trump. You say that you did not vote for him in the primaries and you did not vote for him in the general election. But you end the book noting that even though he's not personally still appealing to you, there's this implicit admiration for the way he's conducted his presidency. And so you don't have to answer this, but I'm curious, are you going to actually vote for him this year?
I haven't decided, but it's mostly because I'm in California and nothing I do matters.
Well, I'm in New Jersey. And so the outcome is foregone here as well.
Yeah, I probably would vote for him just so that I can get the percentage of his support up in the Berkeley count from 5% to 6%.
Well, the book is Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. And we've been joined today by its author, John Yoo. John, thanks so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.